Okay, last time we met, around 5 minutes ago, we defined what, to a certain extent, we defined what bracha is, and the relationship between bracha and bechora. And then what's happening here is what we're at, the final selection between two people. Meaning, the uniqueness about what's happening here in Parshat Toldot, and this clear struggle, in a way that doesn't exist, certainly not on a pshat level, but doesn't exist anywhere near as strongly in the previous generation, is a very, very strong fight between two people for the last chance to be the bearer of bracha. After this, we get to Yaakov. Now, we pointed out that even within Yaakov's children, there's going to be a refinement of that bracha. It's going to consolidate into an individual more than the others. But nobody's going to be selected out. There's no longer a chosen and a not chosen. There's no longer a chosen and one which is pushed to the side. It will stay within B'nai Yisrael, which literally means the children of Yaakov. Yaakov is called Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael. It'll be focused into Levi, but it'll be within Klal Yisrael. This is that last selection. What other pieces of the selection are unique between Yaakov and Esav, as opposed to any other selection that's happened so far?
Yeah. Is they're from the same mom?
Good. In the previous selection where we had Ishmael and Yitzchak, so they were both from Abraham, but one was from Hagar and one was from Sarah. What else? Even deeper. Which is not to exclude it, I'm saying. It's even meaning that's 100% true, and go even more than that. Say even more strongly than that. Yeah.
They're twins?
They're twins. Not only do they share both a mother and a father, but they share the same womb. They share the same, not only the same womb, they share the same genetic material. They're twins. They're both coming from that same origin point. So the nature of the choice here is, first of all, it's the final choice that's being made. Second of all, why does this final choice then have to be between two individuals who are so close, who are sharing the same parents, the same biological material, the same womb, two individuals that are so, so close to each other, this has to be the place of that final distinction? That's our starting question. Bracha.
So remember when you were teaching us about the Dalit Malchut?
You're always there.
Okay.
I need time to catch up to you.
Okay.
Yeah. never mind. You're 100% right.
Continue?
I need time to catch up to you. Yeah, I'm saying we're going to do that right now.
Okay.
Yes. Good. Okay. The Psukim are the first place we're going to look to distinguish between Yaakov and Esav in the Parsha itself. If you take a look at the beginning of the Parsha, in Perek Chafhei, Pasuk Chafhei, take a look inside. Perek Chafhei, Pasuk Chafhei. The two are born as twins. Vayitzeh HaRishon Admoni, Kulo Ka'aderet Zi'ar, Vayikru'u Shemo Esav. The first one comes out red. He has this kind of strong, hairy redness to him, and he's called Esav. Then his brother comes out, and his hand is grabbing onto the ankle of Esav. He's therefore called Yaakov. The two of them grow up, and now we get some sort of distinction between the two once they grow up a little bit. Vayhi Esav Ish Yodea Tzaid Ish Sadeh Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. Now, isn't it clear where the bracha should go and where it should not go, and what the absolute distinction between Yaakov and Esav is, right? Could these two be more different? Could this not be clearer? I think it could be much clearer. There's not a lot to work with here, right? We get a distinction. We're told Esav, he knows how to hunt. He's a man of the fields. Yaakov is Tam, whatever that means, perfect, simple, whole, not so sure. Tam, he likes to sit in tents. which we like to translate as Lexis and Learn Torah, right? Great! So you could say out in the field versus learning Torah, maybe, but why is one inherently better than another? Torah is definitely better, but again, Yosheva Olim doesn't necessarily mean that in Pshat anyway. Meaning, this is all we're getting from the Pesukim. That's the distinction that the Pesukim are giving us. What we need to do is kind of delve into these two Pesukim. We're going to use a lot of Chazal, a lot of it quoted by Rashi, some of it not quoted by Rashi, to see how this initial distinction is going to set up for us the nature of the difference between Yaakov and Esav, which will lead us to, eventually, a conclusion as to why we needed to choose between Yaakov and Esav. Clear where we're going? Yes.
Can I just go back to one point you made before?
Sure.
So if this is the final distinction, then I know you said it's so within Bnei Israel, but why is there a need at all to confer the bracha specifically on Tevet Levi? Why not just keep it?
I apologize. I don't know who Levi is. I don't know who Yosef is. I don't know who Yehud is. I don't know who these people are. I don't even know who Yisrael is yet. Oh, I've got a Yaakov and Esav. Okay? So the Torah is hinting to, in its very short and concise way, something here that's embodied in these words. And if we take a look at Rashi, he's going to quote a lot of Chazals. We're going to utilize Rashi, who's quoting Chazal in this instance, to help us break down a little bit what's really being indicated by these psukim. Rashi says, first of all, in Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, kol zman shayu ktanim, lo hayu nikarim b'masehem, ve'in adam adadik behem mat tivam. Meaning, when they were younger, before they grew up, Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, then we can make this distinction, before it was Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, before they grew up, they were in fact identical. There was almost no way to distinguish them. You couldn't tell from their actions, you couldn't tell from their nature, you couldn't distinguish really between Yaakov and Esav. Only once they get older, because they were so close, again, they're coming from the same womb, they're coming from the same parents, they're coming from the same genetic material. This is the first point of distinction. That's the first thing Rashi helps us out in terms of narrowing down, that that's why we have Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim first. What is the content of Esav when he starts to define himself? So Chazal have a very interesting interpretation of what Yodea Tzayid means. We translate it on a pshat level as a hunted person who hunts. He says, no. Latsud uliramot et aviv befiv. He knew how to trick people utilizing his mouth, which is a different meaning of latsud. He was able to trick his father with his mouth. V'sho'alu abba he'ach ma'asriyat ha'melach ve'at ha'teven v'chule. He would ask his father all kinds of shailas to make his father think that he was from, in modern terminology. That's what he would do. Yeah. He didn't really care. He wasn't who he was. As opposed to, and in contrast to, Yaakov, was an Ish Tam. Ella Kilibo Cain Piv, says Rashi. What's in his heart is exactly what's in his mouth. The contrast that's being drawn here by Chazal, as Rashi is bringing out, from these Psukim, as only Chazal can, but through these Psukim, between Yaakov and Esav, is that Esav is, as we would say in, I think, Lashon Chazal, Echad b'peh ve'echad b'lev. He says one thing, but his internal world is an entirely different place. His outsides and his insides don't match at all. As opposed to Yaakov, who's Echad b'peh ve'echad b'lev, who totally aligns the way that he presents himself with who he is.
Wait, you just said the same thing.
Esav is outwardly one way, internally a different way. Echad b'peh ve'echad b'lev.
Okay.
Sorry, no. Is Echad b'peh ve'echad b'lev. Yaakov is Kilibo kein piv. That's Rashi's terminology. Sorry. He's exactly the same inside and out. Apologize. If we had... So... Yeah.
Is this why Yaakov, I mean, Yitzchak, like, Esav more? Because he needs to be more, like, from, so to speak?
So it could be that somehow, which is hard to say, but you have to say something in this parsha, that Esav was able to convince, at least at the beginning, was able to convince Yitzchak. He was so strong in the way he spoke, that he was able to convince him that he was just that firm.
So that's why Yaakov needs to look like more, is that why?
If you look at the actual Lashon of the Chumash...
I never knew why he needs more if he was...
So it makes more sense to me now if you use this definition. How does when it says a few psukim later, why Yaakov liked Esav more, what does it say? Ki? Take a look down, further down. Should say Ki Tzayed Befiv. Rivka Ohevet Yaakov. Pasuk Chafchet, Perek Chafhei, Pasuk Chafchet, Vayehav, Yitzchak et Esav, why? Ki Tzayid Befiv. If you use this translation, I don't know if Rashi, what Rashi actually says over there. If you use this definition, Vayehav, Yitzchak et Esav, why? Ki Tzayid Befiv. So you could say, Pshat, because he was a hunter, which is odd. Or you could say, no, he loved him because he was, I mean, it's hard to say this about Yitzchak, but that he was tricked by Yaakov, because the Tzayid Befiv Esav was so sharp that he actually convinced Yitzchak to love him more. V'rivka ohevet Yaakov. Rivka saw past that. The depth of the vision of a woman, especially for children. Yes?
Was it Yaakov legitimately that Esav, as Esav was pretending to be? So where was the practice?
Maybe Yaakov was as much in his face. If you're not trying to prove it, you don't have to flaunt it.
What?
I mean, it's not really a fair question, because like, we don't really know why God does things, but... We could have avoided this whole mess if Hashem just said, Yitzchak, like, your kid's tricking you. I'm just saying.
There seems to have been an importance in Yaakov and Esav, we're going to continue to develop, figuring out who's going to get it and fighting it out, and what that teaches us about the distinction between Yaakov and Esav. Let's take it a little bit further first. Yeah, Adina.
Rashi had said that this was the first distinction that there was between them, when it says that Esav was clearly red on the outside when he came out.
It described them, but the psukim, before they really give any meaningful distinction, and those distinctions are also important. Let's go back to what you're pointing out in terms of just what do we know about them even beforehand. So what do we know about Yaakov and Esav? We don't really know anything about Yaakov at that point. The Chumash isn't really descriptive at all. What do we know about Esav? Right.
So Yaakov could have also been red.
He could have, yes. Mm-hmm. But the Chumash intentionally emphasizes that by Esav only. Esav, who we know, through Chazal also, is very killing-oriented. He's a murderer, which is emphasized all throughout Chazal. This comes out, the Mepharshim point out, in the color of his hair. Not to mean that every redhead has murderous or homicidal tendencies. But it does mean, I mean, we do even have in English the concept of a fiery redhead, the concept of there being a little bit more of a passionate personality that might be attached to that color. Not defining it for anybody who may have relatives or friends or may have redhead themselves, but simply that there is something inherent in red which is leaning in that direction. Chazal do talk about that in a few places. His hair is red, his deeds are red, and his actions are red with blood.
Question.
One second, that's come Edina, to answer your question. We do already see aspects of that there, but they're manifesting already here. Meaning, despite the fact that that's who he is, Kitzai Befiv, his father doesn't know because he's busy talking about how firm he is.
So maybe I misunderstood what you just said, but I thought Edina's question was, didn't you just say that this is the first distinguishing factor that is mentioned?
There's nothing in the Pesukim, meaning it says that Esav is red, but it doesn't say that Yaakov's not. It doesn't say that Yaakov, meaning it's not... pointed out in the Pesukim as a distinction. It's descriptive of Esav.
Okay.
It's not defining between Yaakov and Esav, but in fact does help us understand who Esav is and how much he had to be Kitzai Befiv in order to create that illusion for his father that he was more than the horrible person that he was. Yeah.
Does it really matter if it's the first distinction or the second distinction anyway? Like,
because this is going to be the core distinction that we're going to keep coming back
so
to.
So can't this just be the core distinction no matter where it comes up in the text?
Usually the first time something comes up is its origin point. I mean, we're going back to the earliest distinction in Chumash. Chumash is telling us the most primal, basic, definitive distinction, everything else kind of stemming from that. This is the origin distinction. Is there one more hand? We're getting really upset? Okay. Let's take it a little bit further. What we're talking about with Esav, then, is a new type of identity that is possibly more dangerous than we've had before. We're no longer dealing with a case of someone who has negative traits or an affinity toward Ta'ava, like with Yishmael. There were negative aspects to Yishmael, but we're dealing here with something much, much more sinister that needs to be removed from the system. Here we have someone who's a rasha, who's a killer, who's a liar, who's trying to come off as a tzaddik. He's trying to present himself as something that he is not. It's a cover-up and a facade of someone who is the complete opposite. If we were to, in fact, give them two different words, what words might we give Yaakov and Esav then?
Emes and Sheker.
Very simply, Emet and Sheker. Excellent. And excellent, Sifi. Esav is Sheker. And Yaakov is Emet. And the concept of Yaakov being Emet is in all of the Svarim, and that's something we should be coming back to consistently. Right? Titen Emet Yaakov v'chesed l'Avraham. Emet is always linked to Yaakov. But Esav is going to be linked to Sheker. The very nature of Sheker, the very nature of lying, of falsehood, is that it claims that it's the truth. That's the danger of lies. That's the danger of Sheker. It's not just that it's not true. What makes it a sheker, what makes it a lie, is that it's trying to present itself as the truth. The emet also claims it's the truth because it is the truth. So you have these two things which are exact opposites, both claiming to be the exact same thing. Only one is that thing, and one is not that thing. There's a difficulty in distinguishing between the two. The Gemara in Shabbos, on Daf Kuftal and Amar Aleph, gives us a description in terms of how far that will go. And now we are actually going to talk about the physical construction of the letters, but we're talking, it still works here. It works better if you have the, does anybody have good handwriting in block Hebrew?
Maybe.
Would you want to take a crack at it? Try block Hebrew? Just emet and sheker, really, as best you can.
Can I ask a question in the meantime?
Yeah, in the meantime.
So, how is sheker going outside of one's boundaries that...
Going outside of one's boundaries? We didn't take a... Say, what boundaries wasn't used?
No, because Yitzchak was Gevura, which is...
Slowly but surely. We haven't defined Esav as anything yet. We're defining Esav now, and we'll come back to what you're hinting to soon.
Okay.
Good. Except... one slight change.
Make it more blocky?
No, it actually comes down in a chumash like that. Okay. So the Gemara, the words in the Gemara, this is something which is thrown around in drashot and things like that, but it comes from a Gemara, which is kushta kai. Kushta is Aramaic for emet. Truth stands. Shikra lo kai. Sheker, falsity, does not stand. It also manifests itself literally within the letters. If you take a look, emet, all of them all have 2 feet or something with which to stand on. Literally, emet stands. It has 2 feet, or here, I mean, it's not 2 feet, but here is the whole bottom from which to stand on. Sheker, the shin, and the kuf, and the resh, all don't have what to stand on. Meaning, eventually and inevitably, on a literal level, they will fall. What it's hinting to, do you see that? Okay. Eventually they will fall. Lemaisa means that at the end of the day, with enough time, Sheker eventually falls apart and is disproven. If you give Sheker enough time, its true face is doomed to come out and it will be proven that it is not the Emet. It will fall. It will crumble. But it can take a lot of time for that to happen. But at the end of the day, Emet will stand and Sheker will fall. Let's see if this is true of Esav. And if this links back to Esav, we're claiming Emet and Sheker are linked to them. Let's try to link it back in a stronger way and see if it really goes back into the essence of who he is. We have by Esav, a few more minutes, we have an Esav, that Esav is going to turn into a particular koach in the world, and Bruch, I think this is where you were heading. What is the world power?
Don't kill it.
I'm coming back. Let's see if this is true of Esav. Who does Esav become historically as a nation?
Edom.
Coming back to that redness and that concept of Adom. Good, excellent. We're going to get to Galad in 1 second. Now you've aligned with Bracha. So catching up to both of you. The Avinjala he's going to turn to is the Koach of Edom. And Edom turns into a very, very significant power. And we see this from the concept of Yaakov becoming Edom already in his origin story, in the first paragraph of Parshat Toldot, in Perekafei Pasuk Lamed, Vayomer Esav, when Esav says, I will take the lentil soup and you can have the Bechorah. He says, Vayomer Esav Yaakov, halitini na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh keyef anochi alkein kara shemo, Edom. Therefore, he is called Edom for all generations. Edom is Esav. That's on a pshat level, that Edom is Esav. What is Edom? So that comes to what Bracha was already hinting to earlier.
I actually wasn't. I didn't realize that was where you were going.
Oh. Then we finish, then bring back to what you wanted to ask about.
That's the one with the most...
So 1 second, we come back to the Dalet Malchiot. Yes. We have to figure out, now we're going to define it much better than we did previously. To catch those up very quickly who were not here before... There are many, many places in Chazal which tell us that there is a process of 4 exiles that take place over the course of human history. We're not going to go into the details now because we went into the details last semester. We spent like a shiur on it. But it's very easy to find by its name if you want to take a look at it from our previous shiurim. But there are 4 stages of exile that are identified by Chazal, which are linked to Psukim and Daniel. They're linked to actually even the second verse in Chumash itself. Tohu, Vavohu, V'choshech, Al Pnei Zahom are the 4 stages of Galut, and they are defined as the first galut is Bavel, the second galut is it's not anything, that's just something. First one is Bavel, the second is
Parsa.
Thank you, we're coming up in like a week and a half. Pras Madai, right? That's going to be the Purim story. Then we have
Yavan,
and then we have Edom. Now, Some would say that what are these exiles? What are these malchiot? So whenever Israel does something wrong, God punishes us by throwing us out, and as long as we do tshuva, we can come back, and if we stay good, great, and if we sin again, then God will just throw us out again and come up with something new, and then punish us with that, so hopefully we'll do tshuva and come back. But there's no inherent meaning here to the process. This whole sheer series... Everything in the Midrashah is premised on the fact that everything in Judaism is soaked with meaning. If this process of 4 exists, it has to be inherently meaningful, especially when you consider the fact that Chazal link it to a progressional pasuk and link it to the very creation of the world itself. If we assume that it's from the second pasuk of Bereshit, Va'aretz Hayetzah Tohu, Zo Bavel, Bo, Zo Prasu Madai, Tohu, Choshech, Zo Yavan, Al Pnei Tahom is Edom, then we're saying that there is a progression that's built into the Bria itself that's moving further and further and further along with each stage of Galut. We talked about it a little bit when we did the Dalet Malchiot, but we didn't emphasize Edom because we were going to come back to it now, meaning we were holding off. But to summarize what we said before, basically you have finer and finer and finer distinctions that are forcing us to define ourselves in these exiles. The Babylonians, they were barbarians. They came, they attacked, they destroyed, they dispersed us. Nobody wanted any part with the Babylonians. We come to Prasu Madai, the whole beginning of Megillat Esther, is we start to, on a certain level, intermingle with them, or identify with them. We go to Ahasuerus's party. We're having already a little bit of trouble distinguishing. When we get already to Yavan, there's a lot that we have in common. We talked about how these two come from Cham. Yavan's going to come from Yefet, and the bracha to Yefet is Yaf Elokim v'Yefet v'Yishkom v'Leshem. There can be a connection between Yavan and Shem. There can be a connection between Yavan and Klal Yisrael. And it's the first time we see that we have people who are assimilating. We have Mityav Nim. You have Jews who become Greek Jews. Because it's true that you can have a sense and an importance of beauty and have that be linked to Judaism. Yavan is very close, or getting closer to Klal Yisrael, and we have to make a distinction there. Yes, beauty is important, but if it's only external beauty, then it can be distorted and it can be wrong, and there needs to be an internal beauty that we're striving for beyond that. When we get to Edom, that's the hardest and most complex distinction. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he sends us into this exile, is forcing us to define ourselves in a way that he's never asked us to define ourselves before, and on a level that he's never asked us to define ourselves before. What's the historical progression of Esav or Edom? Edom begins as being pagan when originally Edom attacks us, and we have Horem Bayit Sheni. But Edom very, very slowly, but earlier on in history, transforms into the dominant world power, which is embodied by what? Before we get to Western culture, what defined the world? What defined the Roman Empire?
Christianity.
Slowly becomes a representation of Christianity. And from this point forward, we're talking about basically a Christian domination of world culture and power for nearly 2,000 years. What does Christianity claim? What is the claim of Christianity when it is in its origin? I'm not like saying anything that's huge or jaw-dropping here, just definitionally, what is Christianity? How did it develop? Where did it come from? What was the original claim?
Is it
that
for people's
sin? Well, not as specific as that. Yes. The claim was
Jesus.
Or not, unlike these where we're saying you're not the Jews or you're wrong.
They came from
they were Jews.
Not
the new Jews.
Not the new Jews. We are the natural progression. We are the Jewish people. We're God's chosen nation. You just didn't get the memo, right? Your email went to spam. But really, we are you. It's actually a conflict as to who are the bearers of that tradition or not, who is real and who is not real. It's a distinction between one and one that are claiming to be the same thing.
Shaker.
That's the danger of the Gullus of Edom. And historically, if we look at the historical trends of Christianity, we went through a very, very bitter history with Christianity. Christianity, which does, on its front, put forward as its basic things that you have to believe in, you have to go for it, it's what counts if you're part of them, aside from believing in a particular individual. Love, peace, togetherness, those are the fundamentals, and yet we know today that there are more rivers of Jewish blood coming from Christianity while still claiming to hold that banner of love and peace and togetherness. Crusades are an excellent example. Think of the Crusades. The Crusaders were told, this is not, again, I'm not whitewashing history. This is textbook history. This is what happened. The Crusaders were told, you can go, and you can kill, and you can rape, and you can steal, and you're all being forgiven before you even do it. Now go. Now go. Is that love? Is that peace? Is that what Judaism or the claim of the new Judaism is supposed to stand for? And yet we see continuously again and again and again that which has a facade of claiming to be I am the Jew, I am the new Jew, I am the chosen people, putting up a facade of holding up those ideals that on the inside is not the same. Echad bepeh, v'echad belief. Chazal link into this as well. Anytime you see fours, they're very often going to get linked with these because everything in Judaism is soaked with meaning. Always the same basic premise. When we go through the non-kosher animals, there are four animals that are distinguished from the animals, not from the fish, not from the birds. Four animals which are singled out as, by the way, you should know that these are not kosher too. Three of them because they do chew their cud, but their hooves aren't split. And one of them, its hooves are split, and it looks like it's kosher, but know that inside it's not. What animal is that? The chazir, the pig. And Chazal say, Ve'et ha-chazir zo edom. I'm reading from Vayikra Rabbah, Parshat Shmini, Parshat Yud Gimel. It identifies the chazir of all of the four animals as being linked particularly, specifically with Edom. On the outside, it puts on a facade of looking kosher, but on the inside, it's treif. The last selection in Bereshit is between those who on the surface seem to be most similar to each other. Even deeper, one actually claims to be the other. Christianity doesn't claim that Israel is wrong, they claim that they are the new and true Israel. They are complete opposites at their core, but on the surface, they seem the most similar. In our generation, it also has a different manifestation that's basically a similar piece. Christianity is not as strong as it was even a couple hundred years ago. Now we have this dominance of Western culture. Western culture, which promotes a lot of the same ideals of what we're talking about, which is everything is all about. Gosh, is a very firm way of saying it, yes?
Physicality.
How do I look? How do I, not physically, not just physically, but how do I look? How do I present myself? My presenting self is more important than who I am inside. And so much of the struggle that we go through in our early life, in teenage years, in college years, is the struggle with the fact that the world has basically pushed us to create a disparity between who we are and who we present ourselves to be. That's part of all the identity sessions that we have to sit through in high school, right? Is that we're trying to come to terms with a society that pushes us to be a certain way, to present ourselves a certain way, but doesn't that require of us to be any different at our core? When you look at Jewish leaders, we expect them, and they don't always live up to it, we hope that they do, to be exactly as they are on the outside and the inside. There's a classic story told of the professor who comes out of giving an ethics class and is seen doing something totally immoral and says, and the student asks him why, and they say, what's the difference between what happened? Why does anything that happens in class have to do with who I am? There's no expectation that an ethics professor, when they walk out of the classroom, has to act ethically. We don't even have that expectation. Not even necessarily doing anything wrong. There's no assumption that we need to be the same on the outside and the inside. Western culture is the dominance of externality. It's the dominance of presentation, of the outside, of who we look like, of how we look, either physically or how we present ourselves. And Judaism demands of us as being B'nai Yaakov, of being the same on the inside and the outside. But we still live under the dominion of Edom and who Edom is. Edom, who is an Ish Yodei Atzai and Ish Sadeh. Edom, who's the embodiment of Sheker. Edom, who's claiming to be good, and when you look under the veil, is not as good as you expect him to be, or thought he was. And we're fighting to define ourselves in this world against so many things that seem good, that look right, that look moral, that look meaningful. And to figure out, is that what we are or not? That's the final birur of what we have to do. When we do that, we will bring about the pasuk, Va'alu Moshiim, Bahar Tzion, Lishpot et Har Esav. We will judge Har Esav for real in terms of who they are, Va'ita Hashem Emulcha. Then God's true kingdom will be revealed as being coming through Yaakov. This is the battle that's happening between Yaakov and Esav already from the first time they appear as being the origin distinction between the two. That distinction being the origin distinction. And those are the two who are fighting bitterly in the last distinction that's being made in Chumash till we can finally get to the creation of Klal Yisrael. Has to be made between those two who are born from the same mother, the same father, from the same womb, according to Chazal, from the same tipa, from the same sperm and egg, who are born from the same place, who are so similar that they look exactly the same. They seem exactly the same, but are worlds apart, and distinguish between those two to figure out what the truth really is. We'll take this all a whole jump further on Wednesday.